Welcome to the Pop Zara Podcast. Like, love, or follow us today on Facebook, Twitter, and more.
Hello, and welcome back to the Pop Zara Podcast. This is your host, Nathan Evans, managing editor of PopZara.com. It's a website. It's fun. It's free. For now. No, I'm just kidding. It's free forever. Our guest on this mythological episode is none other than acclaimed cryptozoologist and investigator of strange creatures, producer of television programs, and author of many books, Linda S. Godfrey. And speaking of books, her latest, quote, I Know What I Saw, Modern Day Encounters with Monsters of New Urban Legend and Ancient Lore, is available now wherever fine paper, digital, and audiobooks are sold. And by that, I mean Amazon. From Cyclops to Creepypastas, Spirit Cats to Pukwudgies, it's an epistolary journey of stories and research through the worlds of witchy werewolves, cannibal dwarves, spook pooches, dire dogs, and enough animal-human hybrids to make Dr. Moreau jealous. Linda, welcome to the Pop Zara Podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Whew, that was a lot. I think I abused my alliteration quota with all of that. Even our own name is alliteration. But no, thank you. For those who don't know, which is none of you, we were talking before we recorded about the proper pronunciation of one of those creatures. I want to thank Linda very much for making sure I pronounced it correctly. And that was Pukwudgie. Did I get it right?
Yes, that's perfect.
Woo! Okay, trust me, when you see that in print, there's a lot of potential there for things to go wrong. So Linda, book is out, read it, liked it, had a lot of fun. I got a lot of questions because I didn't realize until after I finished that instead of going through a historical look at all the famous creatures that most of us know, like Loch Ness Monster, of course, Bigfoot gets a lot of play here, although he's more of a specter in this. He's more on the sidelines. You introduce a lot of modern creatures through letters that I assume were sent to you through your website. You are a very, very well-renowned cryptozoologist. You've been on television programs left and right. You've produced television programs. You have a very popular website, and you've been doing this a very long time.
27 years.
That is a long time. And as such, you've become an expert on this. And my first question to you is, for those who don't know, I used a big word. I used the word epistolatory, means letters. And so a lot of the stories you relate are letters from people who mm-hmm. claim to have encounters from these creatures. And I will get into some of the more fun names because I had a lot of fun just writing down some of the names of these creatures because mm-hmm. I'm going to use them in my day-to-day life. For example, I had never heard of Pukwudgie. I had heard of creepypasta, but I never heard of witchy werewolves. I never thought to put cannibal dwarves together. Spook pooches was fun. Lots of dogs. And by your own admission, canines make up a large portion of these creatures, especially Wisconsin-based canine creatures, because you're from Wisconsin.
Right, exactly. And that story that with which I sort of broke into the field of cryptozoology without even knowing what it was at the time, again, 27 years ago, concerned upright, unknown canines that looked like walking on their hind legs, German shepherds or wolves. So that's kind of, so I've kind of become known for that little corner of the crypto world, and people tend to contact me just because I'm known for that.
I will say this. I'm sort of a purveyor of local bookstores, and one of the marks of a very good local bookstore, and our producer Chris can attest to this. We went on a road trip this year and we did this. I always try to look out for the local flavor. And as you probably know, a good local bookstore will have a good section of local things. And usually among the local things are things like cryptozoology, local legends, local myths, local creatures. For those who don't know, most of us should be familiar with Loch Ness and Nessie, of course, but most of them are not in Scotland. But what your book details is that there are probably hundreds of different creatures and sightings and local myth and local legend. I thought it was fascinating. And again, most of the ones you list are listed in Wisconsin. But as you prove, Wisconsin is known for more than just cheese. You have lots of upright dogs, upright dog ladies. Let me go through a little list real quick. I'm sorry. Again, I do not want to get this wrong because I will get letters. White buffalo calf woman, the Oglala deer woman, the Texas lobo girl, mobile wolf woman, and dog woman. You wrote this, so I have to say a lot of these are female-oriented. Did you notice that too when you were documenting how there just seems to be an overwhelming preference for a lot of these creatures to be female?
Well, in this case, I was showing that there actually were some female ones because usually they're not mentioned unless An eyewitness happens to see one in contemporary times running across the road with a couple of little pups at its heels, you know, and you can tell it looks like a little family, so it makes you think that they are reproducing here, which is another sort of strange thought. But if you go back a couple of volumes of my work to American Monsters, you'll find out that's the one that's a compendium of all the different types, you know, and I have them organized by land, by sea, and by air. So this was an instance where I started out with a really kind of mind-bending urban legend tale about this dog lady that was seen on the grounds of an old sanatorium. And what I wanted to show was that there really were other legends about dog women, dog ladies, but that they sort of differ from the normal run-of-the-mill assumed to be male encounters, because they always have very specific legends about them, and it seems like there's only one. You know, when you go back to the dog men or the man wolves or whatever you want to call them, what showed up to my knowledge on Bray Road, they're more generic. You can find the same exact creature just about anywhere in the United States, Canada, South America, and they're doing much the same thing. These other ones, the dog lady, whatever, they each have their own private legend, and some of them, the one in Mobile was described as being pretty with an illustration showing it with long blonde hair and kind of mascaraed eyes, and then the rest of it's a dog. So, you know, it's just really strange. But the dog lady or dog woman one have quirks. They're quirky. There's something different about them. And that's what I was sort of highlighting in this book.
Now, you did mention something I want to go into detail real quick about. You mentioned Bray Road. And for those who don't know, you wrote a very famous, very popular book called The Beast of Bray Road. And from what I can gather, that caused a little kerfuffle inside the cryptozoology world, whereas, correct me if I'm wrong, because I really do not want to get this part wrong, that there were some people who mistook the Beast of Bray Road for a Bigfoot, and the discussion dissolved sort of into the differences between Bigfoot and the Beast of Bray Road. And I believe that the big marking difference would be one would be more canine and one would be less canine, correct?
That's very correct, yeah. There's a period of about maybe 15 years, which is from the time that it started up until maybe, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, when the dog man or the Beast of Bray Road just wasn't getting any love from a lot of the Bigfoot enthusiasts. And I think it's great that there are two different ones, because it makes this story stronger that we've got several different unknown creatures running around here. But it's such a difference if you know anything at all about zoological anatomy, because you not only have the difference in the height and weight. The Bigfoots range usually 6 to 8 feet tall and several hundred pounds, if not more, where the dogmen are more, I don't want to say dainty because they're not dainty, but they're much slimmer in the hip area. They walk on their hind legs like the Bigfoot, but they're walking on their toe pads. There's a fancy word for that, digitigrade, whereas the Bigfoot walks plantigrade or flat-footed like we do, and their footprints look like ours. The upright canines, their footprints look like wolf prints, like oversized wolf prints. Also, if you see the heads, Bigfoot, you very seldom see any sort of ear structure, whereas with the dog men, you always see the pointy ears sticking up on top of the head, and you'll see a long muzzle with fangs. The Bigfoot may have a slightly elongated muzzle. There's a better word for that. Prognathic, I think, is the word that means that it does jut out a little bit, but not like a dog's or a canine's, and a little bit more than a human. So it's sort of somewhere in between. And if they get a look at its backside, the Bigfoot does not show a tail, whereas the canine creature almost always does. The eye shine is different with the Bigfoot. It's usually an orange or red glowing. And with the canine, it's almost always the normal canine color.
Well, going back to what you were talking about with the digits for a second, I think that becomes the biggest distinction in this discussion. Because if the legends of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and whatever he goes by, or excuse me, whatever he or she goes by, let's be fair, that the idea that they would be a biped, correct, and that they would be designed to walk on 2 feet, very much like humans. Whereas the dog people, the dog creatures you discuss, many of the stories have one fact in common, is that they have these animals, and they can revert to becoming quadruped as well.
Right.
They can go back on four and gallop away, and in some cases jump into the trees and do all sorts of amazing things, which is my big.
Or the river, or the nearest roof, or cornfield, anywhere that gives cover.
I was going to say, so I have to ask this question before we get on, because I think everybody listening is asking the same exact question. And for those who have not read your work before or read this book, which I'm hoping that will change after this, I encourage everyone to read it. It's very fun. That, again, most of the stories you relate are people who write to you, presumably because they've seen you on television, they've heard you on podcasts, hopefully they'll heard you on here, and they relate stories. I got to tell you, I have to ask a question, and you kind of address this in the book a little bit, but are some of the stories that you include for laughs, some of the stories sound to me like a bad fiction that people...
I know what you mean. I do. Well, the thing is, no, I mean, because I parse these things, you know, much more tightly than anybody reading them would, and there are a certain number that I just don't use. There are many, many red flags that cause me to put them in a separate folder and never look at it again. But my main thing is, usually these are organized in a certain way where people can see that I'm addressing certain topics, and there are some that are just really wild, but if they address the topic and they sound like some of the things that other people have been writing, you know, I'll do my best to check it out. If it's any place that I can get to physically, I will go and interview them face to face. For instance, in my last book, there was one where a whole family in church saw a woman turn into what looked like a werewolf right before their eyes. Which, you know, I don't believe in actual werewolves. I say that in every book, and I still say it in the old European or Hollywood Lon Chaney style, where the whole body is changing. But there are some possible psycho, beyond normal things that people, such as medicine men from certain tribes and mystics from certain different religions, claim to be able to do. And I'm not able to judge those. That was what was at stake in this one. But I took my husband with me on one of three trips that I went to, made a drive to another city. We went three times, talked to them face-to-face. They were excellent people. They did not want their names known. They told me a bunch of certain facts that they did not even want published, which sounded kind of crazy, but I went and traced them down and found every single detail matched. And because it really shed some light on some other things on the topic that I was addressing in Monsters Among Us, I decided to include it. And I always try and take care to add the caveats that I find, you know. And my purpose in all of these books, right from the very beginning, is not to just tell lots of scary stories to make people go, ooh, help. I want people to think about these things in context with one another. And what it gets down to for me every time is, why are all these people seeing these same things? Most of them have no idea until they see one and start looking that other people are seeing them, or that there's somebody like me recording them. But what is it? It's a really strange phenomenon when you stop and think about it, that there are all these sane, sober, sensible people. Once in a while, someone will admit that they were drinking, but it sobered them up really fast.
But I was going to say, drinking is a common element in many of these stories.
Lots of times the sightings occur because people put them out where these creatures are likely to be, which is between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. at night. Usually, either if in cities, it's usually by the outskirts of a city, or more normally, it's in the woods or by a campfire or in a field or something like that, and they're out having fun with their friends or smoking or whatever. But really, more of the sightings are just seen by regular citizens going back and forth to work or on vacation, or, you know, just whatever they have to do that puts them out on the roads at night and gives them a little more chance. And not all of them are nighttime. There are many that are daytime too. So I'm always looking for something that leads me along this little perilous trail of searching for clues that somehow associate them and can help us to understand the context in which they're occurring and why it is. Are these all Jungian archetypes that we carry in our brains and then for some reason are just sort of peeked into existence while we're driving out at night? That's just one thought. I mean, are there creatures from another dimension? A lot of people believe that. What is it that is causing all of these sightings?
Well, to be fair, you do make an admission that you draw a distinction between folklore and myths, and I was really surprised, and I think people who are hesitant or might be on the fence about reading your work should understand that you do go out of your way to say that you are respectful to myths and you take these stories seriously as the people themselves take them seriously, and that the difference of myth could be the difference of religion, could be a native religion, could be Judeo-Christian religion. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about real quick. As someone who lives in Kansas for the last 20 years, I lived a hop, skip, and a jump away from Stahl, Kansas. And Stahl, Kansas was famous for having what they called a haunted church. It was actually a tourist attraction. They made movies about it. And when people come from out of town, it's, you know, if you go there, it's a little know-nothing town in the middle of nowhere. But if you drive by, there's always tourists there looking to see ghosts or looking to see the devil and looking to see this. And you know, they see what they want. But one thing I was going to ask you about, and you can confirm this for me or not, but the feeling I got when I was reading some of the stories is that you gather these stories from local people, from local areas, a lot that you can visit, a lot that you can't. And the impression I had is that the flavor of the stories changes as the communities that they come from age. For example, you give an example about UFOs. And I thought that was, to me, the most fascinating part, where you actually have found folklore about UFOs that predates NASA, even in this 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And so my question is, when you were able to connect that sort of thing, when you get a story about a man who says, "I saw a dog," I notice there's a lot of times in the stories, there's a caveat that says, "It looked like the creature from this movie," or "It looked like the skeleton from this TV show." And they're reaching for something that they can identify, they can tell you what it looked like. And I'm wondering if that's not more true than it seems. When we go back to, and now this book doesn't talk about it a lot, but when you hear stories of people who see Mother Mary, you know, Mary Magdalene in a potato chip, or in a, you know, they see something, most of us are aware of, you know, Rorschach tests. You know, what do you see in the ink blot? Or look up to the sky and what do you see in the cloud? I'm almost wondering, and I don't know if you do this when you write, that a lot of us are sort of are predisposed for these type of stories because our own mythologies, our own stories are encoded, not just in our language, but in our culture. And the impression I had from that, of course, is Native American culture. Again, anybody who spent any time near local Native people will tell you this is deeply entrenched in their culture in a way that is unheard of in most other cultures. And that's an interesting dichotomy. And that's the sense I got from a lot of the stories you sent, is that even if the people don't necessarily believe in Bigfoot or the walking or the upright dog, they still believe in the mythology of it, and they sort of protect it.
They do, and it's a phenomenon. That's how I usually put it. I believe that it is a phenomenon. It's just an unexplained phenomenon, and that's what people say. They say, you know, "I don't know what it was, but I know what I saw," hence the title of the book. And I hear that over and over and over. The other thing that people will say to me is, "All I want," they say, "I don't want anything for this. I don't want my name in. All I want is to talk to somebody who won't tell me I'm crazy." You know, they seek this sort of fellowship so that, and lots of times people will ask to get in contact with one another, and they'll, you know, share their stories and make comparisons, and they all say it really is sort of healing for them, because a lot of them say they feel something like post-traumatic stress disorder after seeing this, because they're left thinking, there was this thing. I didn't know that such a thing existed. You know, what is my world after this? Their world paradigm sort of changes. And they often also say, not a day goes by that I don't think about that and why I was the one to see it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminded me of when you hear, I don't know if you know this, but there was a new Godzilla movie that came out this year. It was called Godzilla King of Monsters. And have you seen it?
Yeah. I did not, no, but I saw the reviews and the trailers for it and everything. I just never got around to that one particular one.
I don't think a lot of people did, but I saw it. I liked it. I'm predisposed to Godzilla, and the impetus of this movie was that all of human history, they look at maps, they look at the cave paintings, they look at local flavor, and that there've been these big monsters that predate, that they've always been here. And I noticed this as a theme running through again and again and again. And because I got to tell you something, Linda, there have been so many movies about Bigfoot just in the last 2 years. I grew up with Harry and the Hendersons. I grew up with a few big Bigfoot movies. But my goodness, I have never seen a call to Bigfoot love. And that includes live action Bigfoot movies. It includes animated Bigfoot movies. And I'll say it. There's attempts to make Bigfoot erotica a thing. And okay. I don't think that it worked for werewolves and vampires. I don't think it's working for Bigfoot. But children's cartoon, and there was even a crazy movie that came out this year called The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot, starring Sam Elliott and his mustache. Oh. And his mustache is just as famous and hairy as Bigfoot. But they keep coming. They keep coming and they keep coming. And they're more popular than ever. And as you probably know, there's user groups, there's news groups, there's get-togethers.
Tons of groups, and it's all different cryptozoology things. It's just exploded in the last maybe 3 years, cryptids.
Yes, and that's what I was going to ask you. So you taught me a new word, cryptids. Now, most of us are familiar with chimeras, of course, you know, animal-human hybrids and all this stuff, and those stories have been famous forever. But when you look at something like Bigfoot, and again, I mentioned that Bigfoot is not necessarily a main character in your new book, but he's more of a presence because so many things get compared to Bigfoot, whether it's the dog people, the cat people, whatever, that Bigfoot is a presence. And Bigfoot seems to be the star of cryptozoology now in a way that I don't think Nessie or Shampi or anything else has. When you look at the way Bigfoot has existed throughout different cultures, through different names, through different local cultures, my question to you is, and I don't want to spoil this for anybody, but you do have a chapter in your book that says, I saw Bigfoot, and I will not reveal that chapter. Why do you think Bigfoot, more than anything else, has become emblematic of cryptozoology?
Well, I think there are more sightings of it than any of the others. I think because it's so large, if it is present on a landscape anywhere, it's hard to miss. One reason that there are so many sightings of it, but I also think it's the closest to us. You know, people have talked about encountering them when they were out hunting, drew a bead on it with their rifle or whatever, and then couldn't fire because the face was just too human, and the body was too human, the way it moved was too human. And indeed, there are quite a number of Native American tribal people, especially in the Northwest, who have talked about Bigfoot as a separate type of human, but human. And there are different legends that all kind of have to do with dealing with them and their cannibalism toward the regular humans, and so making war against them, and usually they're defeated in some cave somewhere, but there are a few left here and there. And I've got that, I think, in my first book, Beast of Bray Road. I was tracking down those legends, and I found a lot more since then. And they were called the Hairy Chest People by one tribe of Algonquians, which just indicates that their main noticeable feature to us is the amount of hair on them all over their bodies. So that, I don't know if that answers your question, but it has a lot to do with their availability and the fact that they look like us.
You know, just to look at recent history in the last 300 years and, you know, what people would call colonization, or some people would call genocide, when what we call civilization meets local people, it usually doesn't work out very well for the local people. And, you know, you have unfortunately numerous cases in North America with, you know, entire tribes being either assimilated or wiped out. In Japan, you have the Ainu people, you have this, where you have civilizations that were so dominant. I know in Australia, you know, we have the Aborigines. My question is it possible that there were different tribes of people that were more physically related to what we would consider Bigfoot, like you said, hairy-chested or brawnier, that may have just been bred out of existence or may have been hunted out of existence through, you know, the natural progression of war and assimilation?
Yeah, and maybe not totally out of existence, but into some of the more remote places, and now there are enough that they're coming forward again. But that is the general idea, that most of these northern and northwestern tribal people have. And again, I'm talking about the west coast of the U.S., Northern California, Oregon, and then up into Canada are where a lot of them are thought to. That's where those legends usually originate.
You know, one last thing real quick before I change the subject. When people talk about legends, they talk, you know, you can go back and you can see stories about the beasts of the sea. You know, we talked about Loch Ness and whether Nessie or Nessie's relatives exist today. You know, you can look back at any type of illustrative documentation and you could see men crossing the ocean and fighting serpents. You could find this. And what's funny is that I think people have finally started to make the connection is that what may have happened is that there may have been a discovery of ancient dinosaur fossils. You know, we've seen amazingly preserved fossils on the walls of caves. If you see these things that look like a giant serpent, it's really easy to extrapolate that these things were probably in the ocean at one point and that they become urban legends. And I'll be honest with you, Linda, that if a lot of randy sailors can look over the side of a boat and see a bunch of hairy manatees and somehow equate those with beautiful women, then I can easily believe that someone can see an upright bear and somehow think that's a humanoid, easily.
Yeah, one would think, although it happens over and over and over and over and over again, that they insist it's not a bear, you know, and I can go ahead and list anatomical differences there too, but then you have talking about the men out in the open ocean fighting beasts for a long time. There were older engravings of what looked like giant squids and octopuses, often known as the Kraken, that would attack ships. And now we're finding these squids that are indeed
monstrous, giant,
as big as they were described in the books. And so much of the ocean is unknown and unexplored, and we keep finding new things and bigger things all the time. So, and also, I read recently, I can't source it for you right at the moment, but there have been geological surveys that they're starting to find some of these caverns and tunnels between way deep in the ocean, leading from one place to another, that people have speculated for a long time, people interested in these things, that creatures that look like Nessie, for instance, the long-necked plesiosaur type of thing, might be able to swim from one body of water to another, and that's how you explain that there really isn't usually enough food to sustain them.
I will say this, no spoilers, but I mentioned the new Godzilla movie a few minutes ago. Those underwater tunnels factor in quite a bit to the plot.
Oh, do they? Oh, interesting. Mm.
So yeah. I hope children don't believe that Godzilla is a real creature, but I kind of hope they do a little bit. The world could use a little Godzilla, but it is fascinating though. It's the idea is that we think we know everything and we think that we can prove everything by visual touch, but I will say but going back to a little bit about the book. I was kind of joking when I talked about the hairy manatees and somehow them being transmogrified into sexy women, but a theme inside a lot of the stories, and I found it a little disturbing. A lot of your stories talked about the dog women being beautiful and pretty, and I noticed this was something that seemed to happen in more modern takes. Do you think there's an explanation for that?
Well, the more modern takes, you know, you have all the, think of all the Hollywood B movies in the 50s and the posters that were made of them. And then also think of the sideshow art from that age and a little before that, too, where you had these unfortunate people with differently together bodies or afflictions or whatever, and you'd see the advertisements for them. There'd be a beautiful long-haired woman, and then they'd show, she was maybe, say she was Turtle Woman, you know, and then they'd attach that beautiful head and hair to the turtle-like body. And I'm just making one up. I don't think there was a Turtle Woman, but you get the picture. So
there could be. The ocean is deep, and it is long.
One never knows.
One never knows. But it is interesting, though. It is interesting what the mind can put together. And I think that's the, I think ultimately that's what I got from the book. And I'm wondering if people will think the same, is that even if the stories do seem embellished, even if they do seem to have that local, you know, that local evolutionary flavor that people like to add on to it after a while, there does seem to be some value in why these people are talking about these legends and about why they seem to be congregated in certain areas.
Yeah, and that's what keeps me going. You know, I just remain curious every time I get another letter, and I just had a really wonderful one that came in yesterday that I'm hoping to get put up on my blog, which is lindagodfrey.com, by the way. And it's about a man who was held upside down by his ankles by a Bigfoot. So that's all I'm going to say right now. Because I haven't examined it, I haven't interviewed the man. You know, I have a lot of my due diligence to work upon it right now. But out in the woods with another companion, and this is the companion who was there with him at the time that wrote the report. Weighed like over 200 pounds.
I look forward to seeing that part. I look forward to seeing most Bigfoot things. I can't get enough of Bigfoot. Like I said, I can't get enough of Bigfoot. I can't get enough of cryptids, which I know that word now. I can't get enough of cryptozoology because I'm kind of like Fox Mulder in X-Files. That I want to believe. I want these things to be out there. I don't want us to know everything. I want us to, like I said, when they discovered the giant squid and the octopus, I was fist pumping in the air. I was like, yes, it's real. You know, Jules Verne was real. He was right.
Yeah, and the Kraken was real. All those seafarers.
Yeah, I want dinosaurs to exist. I want them to exist, but I also don't want them to exist in a way because I don't want them to be exploited and put in zoos. But as far as venturing out in the woods and coming across a growling creature and you know, dropping my beer as I'm running and then telling this story and saying, well, all the people that were there aren't gone. There's value in stories like that too, and I do appreciate how in the book you sort of draw conclusions to like funky teen horror movies where idiotic teens go in the forest and they end up getting killed by whatever. I think that's the natural conclusion. If you're gonna go out into a scary place, you know, where there's known creatures, then you're probably gonna be eaten up. That's just how it goes. You've seen the movies.
Be prepared to be shredded.
Be prepared. I did want to talk real quick before I go about one thing, and I have to ask about this. The subtitle of the book, Linda, is Modern Day Encounters with Monsters, New Urban Legend. There is one chapter of the book. I don't know why you included it, but I'm really curious, and I'm not offended, but I'm just really curious. You have a chapter about little people. And specifically, my favorite chapter in the book was the story of the Haunchies. And it was so visually illustrative of, you have this secretive town or village where little people live in little huts, and they're protected by a black pickup truck with a man with a shotgun. And don't go near the Haunchies because they might come after you with pitchforks. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. I'm not being politically correct here, but I had a good laugh at that. And
well, you know, I like to call them small people because that's basically really all they are. The reason, well, there were a couple of reasons I included it. One is that it's a very strong legend around this certain part of Wisconsin, and it's handed down and handed down, and people are really, really interested. And then I discovered when I began doing work with Mark and Mark of the Weird U.S. series that they also had found certain colonies of people that were, you know, height challenged, if you want to say that, that were living together in colonies and had appropriately sized homes, not only in Wisconsin, but New Jersey and Florida. And they had each had their own names. The other thing is that I had, if you read the whole thing, I had personal evidence from somebody that I knew who knew of one of these colonies of retired circus and sideshow performers who did have very private little communities, usually by a lake, just wanting to be by themselves. And I know this woman who saw one, you know, it wasn't one of the little people. The other thing, there was one other reason, which was to distinguish these sorts of small humans, smaller people for whatever reason, from the spiritual little people of Native Americans, both of which have very prevalent legends. Mm-hmm. And they're very different things, very different things.
When I the first thing I thought about when you talked about the haunchies, I said, I thought to myself, well, you could easily just see them. They're probably registered with the local city hall, you know, for a community. I mean, they have to have electricity. I mean, they're going to want to watch Game of Thrones. But it almost made it sound like they were some villainous, like, Smurf village, like that you came across this mountainous people of small people, and they came after you with a... They came after you with bats and pitchforks, and I thought to myself, it's just the visual.
I can't make this stuff up.
I was going to say it was great. It sounded so crazy, but I've heard of those things before as well, especially with circus performance. Especially now that, you know, the idea of what we used to call freaks has become obsolete. And I know most circuses have gone defunct. I know Barnum and Bailey, I think, or the Ringling Brothers is finally gone. And, you know, and I think a lot of people who I think we can all agree that a lot of the Broadway appeal of those type of acts have gone over to reality television. And that
I think so, too. Well, and, you know, the other very strong thing about these that makes me think they're not just some urban legend, but instead they're actual recording of something that happened, but much, much, much embellished, is that at all of these sites, the ones that Mark found and the one in Wisconsin and in another one in Wisconsin that I won't get into, there were circus overwinter headquarters there. Delavan, Wisconsin, which is not very far from where the haunchies are, and from the one that I know about, that actually became, for a long time, it was America's circus capital. And Clown Museum, National Clown Museum, holder, and there's still on their town square, there's an oversized statue of a giraffe and an elephant and a clown right there in the middle of the town. And that was the same thing, especially for the one in Florida that Mark found. That was another big circus colony. So there is this fact upon which these legends are set. You know, people read the unusual facts of small people, retired from circus, seem reclusive. Okay, so somehow these legends grow up around them.
And we didn't even get into things like modern-day legends like creepypastas or this bizarre fascination with clowns that has recently popped up, which has been terrifying for a lot of people. It's bizarre to me. And I think the Internet itself, Internet and Facebook and YouTube and all that, they've allowed these sort of things to metastasize in a way that I don't think would have happened before. Before it was just word of mouth, but now it's videos and this and that. But people still love them. They still watch the movies like Blair Witch Project. They still watch the found footage. Even though they know it's not real, there's something that attracts them to it. I think I would say, Linda, that they're in love with the idea of the impossible. And because it allows us imagination. And, you know, allows us to use our sort of cultural imagination in a way we can't do it elsewhere. Right. And I think that's fun.
I hope that my books are helping to dispel the notion that there can't be something unknown out there, that we can't still discover things, that there's some hope for that.
Oh, I would hope that we discover stuff all the time. I love it. We always talk about we can't chop down the rainforest because we may discover a mold that will help cure cancer, or we have to replant trees in the wilderness. But I also think that if they were ever to come across a village of magical gnomes or elves, that we would be respectful to them too. Like you said in the book, some cultures think of elves as cute and jolly, others think of them as terrifying devils. And I would hope that the elves we discover are more on the cute Santa Claus side, because I like presents, and I think people would rather get presents instead of curses and hexes. But speaking of curses and hexes, I think that's a good place to wrap this up. And with that, you have been listening to the Pop Zara podcast. This has been Nathan Evans talking with acclaimed cryptozoologist, author, and all-around nice person, Linda S. Godfrey, talking about her brand new book, I Know What I Saw, Modern Day Encounters with Monsters of New Urban Legend and Ancient Lore. It's available now. You should go read it. It's available. Well, Linda, thank you very much for showing up. I really appreciate it. And we'll make sure we get links to the book and all that fun stuff.
I would love to see those.
You've been listening to the Pop Zara podcast. For more quality original content, check out popzara.com for the latest reviews and previews in gaming, movies, tech, and more.